This program is sponsored by Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts. Located at 185 Worcester Street, right on Route 9, they can be reached at 508-545-8105 or at wickedchronicvendorcommerce.com. Wicked Chronic is a boutique-style retail shop that focuses on selling counterculture products such as Wiccan, cannabis cultures coming together in a unique setting. You need something for that special spell? Go on down to Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts and speak to Beverly. Tell them Dr. Chris sent you. Check them out today.
Louis Vendredi made a deal with the devil to sell cursed antiques, but he broke the pact, and it cost him his soul. Now his niece Mickey and her cousin Ryan have inherited the store, and with it, the curse. Now they must get everything back, and the real terror begins. Much more than the blood of a vixen to satisfy a vampire's lust for eternal life.
Hang on to the cake. Don't let it go.
Hang on for your life as you travel back in time on a special Friday the 13th. Ah! It's a one-way ticket to terror, rapture, and relentless rage.
She's mine now.
An all-new episode of Friday the 13th, the series. Next week, there's simply no escape.
Welcome to the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to all the canceled television shows in the horror, science fiction, and fantasy genre. I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And Happy New Year to everybody. As the day we're recording this, it is December 31st, 2017. The day that it airs will be the day after my birthday, January 5th, 2018. So goodbye, 2017. Hello, 2018. Let's see what will be different. We don't have any presidential inaugurations to worry about at the beginning of this year.
No, just the midterm elections, so don't forget about those.
No, we also have the State of the Union address coming up, too.
That's going to be great. All right.
I'm going to watch that with Stephen Colbert and those late-night people doing their commentary over it.
You know, you need to actually have some sort of drinking game with it, where, like, every time he says, it's great, it's wonderful, or incredible, you take a shot.
Yeah, I swear to God, if anyone doesn't possibly believe, and we're not very political on the show, but you have to admit this, even if you're not a political person and you don't tune in the show for politics, you have to watch the first State of the Union address by President Trump this year, because you know it's going to be ripped to part by critics and everybody. It's going to be the best one ever. But before we get to our episode covering the 13th episode of Friday the 13th, the series, or Friday's Curse, which is, we wanted to play that little intro, which is basically the commercial that was played, you know, introducing people to the TV series, and then, of course, the opening song. We also play it in honor, of course, that out of the four main cast members, there are four, when only three of which we've met so far, and we'll meet the fourth one in season three, we lost Chris Wiggins earlier this year. So also it's an honor that we play it for him, because he died, I think, in February or January of this year. He was the first of the four main cast members to pass away, so that's kind of a big deal. It's kind of like how this year was like the first year we also lost members of the Alien films. We lost like three of them this year. We lost John Hurt, we lost Bill Paxton, and then we lost Harry Dean Stanton also passed away.
Ah, yeah.
And he was Brett. He also has one of the best roles in the movie The Avengers. If you've seen The Avengers, Mr. Seneca, the scene when Mark Ruffalo wakes up after he crashes to Earth as the Hulk, and the old man security guard is just like, son, you got a problem, you should deal with it. He's like, did I hurt anybody? He goes, no, you scared the hell out of a bunch of chickens, though. Here, I waited until you shrunk down so you could put these pants on.
Yeah.
Like, he recognizes who the Hulk is and knows the Hulk's Bruce Banner, so when he wakes up, he'll be the Bruce Banner and he can fit into these pants. But, yeah, that's Harry Dean Stanton, and he's actually in a documentary, I think, coming out, or it's out already, called No Small Roles, and it's all about actors in Hollywood who have made their names being in small parts in films. I mean, Brett is kind of a small part in Alien, even though he's one of the main cast members, but he's not a huge part in that movie. I mean, he's got a little that little part, again, in the Avengers, you know what I mean? And a lot of people point out, like, oh my God, it's Harry Dean Stanton talking to the Hulk. So again, we lost three members of the Alien films this year, which is pretty funny. But we'll move along from that. God, can you imagine we might get an Alien TV series out of Disney?
Well, technically, wouldn't that make any Xenomorphs Disney princesses because they're born from the Alien Queen?
I guess so, but I hate everyone always, like, going, oh my God, they're a female, now they're a Disney princess, so is Buffy, so is these...
Well, they could be prince or princess. I mean, I guess they're kind of neuter, really.
I know, but the thing is, like, Jesse and the Black Widow and the Scarlet Witch, they're not princesses, and they're all owned by Disney now.
No, they don't have royal blood.
You know, Aggie Ventures, which is a Star Wars Sith Lord, or any of the other female characters in Star Wars that is not Padme Amidala or Leia Organa.
Queen. They call it the Queen.
Yeah. And maybe she'll kill all the Disney princesses and we can be done with it. I can just see the Xenomorphs popping out with, like, blonde hair and black hair and, you know, a fishtail.
And starting their song and dance routines a la Spaceballs.
God. I know I started it. So, we have gift exchange between Mr. Zeneca and I before we begin our coverage of this. So, I'm going to open up mine now, which I actually cracked open the tape already, but I didn't look through it yet, so I have no idea what's in here.
Okay. Right. So, to give some information to our listeners here, we actually selected gifts for each other that were kind of regional to our areas and that we thought the other person would enjoy.
Yes, correct. So. I have no idea what's in here, and hopefully she doesn't figure out that the hard thing I gave her is... could be only one of a few things.
I've not opened mine yet. I'm waiting
God
for you.
God damn, they put enough paper in here. I gotta go through it all to make sure I don't accidentally throw something away. Alright, there we go. Okay, what do we got? We got...
The Mutter Museum is a museum here in Philadelphia that contains medical oddities.
Uh-huh.
And it basically covers things that are the more unusual, like the conjoined twins, most expanded colon, the kind of like person with elephantitis bones, a wax soap woman. You know,
oh,
so
speaking of John Hurt, the Elephant Man.
Yeah, so it is an interesting museum. I definitely recommend that anyone to visit Philadelphia go to the Mutter Museum because you could spend a day and actually see like books bound with real human skin that aren't the Necronomicon. So in your gift, you should have like a poster.
Yeah, I got that. I got a cookie cutter with two heads.
Yes. Yes, the conjoined twin gingerbread cookie cutter.
Oh, my God, that is so awesome. I'm going to make conjoined twin... Oh, and it's got a recipe, too, to make gingerbread men, which is fantastic because I don't know how to make gingerbread men. Oh, wow, this is, like, some in-depth fucking gift. If, like, I had, if I was there in person, I'd put my arms around you in a big hug because I'm crying right now. I gotta make it up that we go. My girlfriend and I have been talking about trips that we want to take, and I said, you know, I want to go to Pennsylvania for a couple reasons, and Mr. Zeneca is one of them.
Aww.
Oh, this is so cool. The Mutter Museum. The poster looks really freaking cool. So this is like Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Kind of, except it's all done from an extremely medical slant. So, you know, there's a wall that has different diseases of the eye, which is kind of freaky to look at. So, since this was kind of a physician's museum, everything is very clinical. So, it's not like a Ripley's Believe It or Not where it's sensationalized. It's just, it is. And that's what makes it cooler,
wow,
in my opinion.
And I got a beer glass. That is awesome. And the little information in the thing that sticks out, the Mutter Museum, you know, like the pamphlet that goes to the museum is also filled with postcards.
Yeah.
That is wicked freaking cool. Okay, open yours.
Okay. All right, so I want to open mine. This package here. Ooh. Let's see. Take it out. Got a card. And, oh my god. H.P. Lovecraft, the mysterious man behind the darkness. Oh, wow. It's a hardcover book.
H.P. Lovecraft being very local here to Rhode Island. Well, not Massachusetts per se, but New England, obviously. He's buried here in Rhode Island.
Oh, and this is a lot of really great pictures. I love the formatting.
Yeah, it comes from a bookstore here in Providence that sells a ton of H.P. Lovecraft style books and stories, obviously the ones he wrote, republished and such. And the public library here we don't have like an H.P. Lovecraft store. I don't think he has enough work to sustain his own store, but a lot of the bookstores, obviously a lot of the used bookstores, carry a lot of his work, and then biographies about him as well.
Oh, thank you. And then the card inside says, "To Mr. Seneca, thanks for being my co-host on our great podcast, Dr. Chris."
Aww.
Love, love, love.
Lots of love. All right, enough with the gooey shit. Let's get right to the brass tacks of this episode. But this is awesome because I'm going to totally hang this up and then I'm going to make gingerbread men as soon as I get everything I need for the recipe. Because I've never made gingerbread men
awesome.
Before. I'm not a big baker, but every instant in a while when it's something that is thrown my way to bake, I'm like, oh, yep, I'm going to totally do this. So I'm
just
gonna
get some of those like Pillsbury dough cookie rolls, you know? Spread them out and make little sugar cookies that are two-headed.
Oh,
they
true.
Don't have to be gingerbread.
Oh, definitely. But I definitely want to try to make gingerbread man because I've never made it before, so.
Yeah.
All right, so the first episode, the 13th episode, as I made the joke earlier, which is really nice, is
it's a vampire-themed
episode. A vampire-themed episode, which is funny considering we started this podcast a year ago with vampires for the television series Kindred the Embraced.
Yeah, it's full circle in a year, huh?
Exactly. I thought that was actually pretty poetic. And the episode is The Baron's Bride. Mr. Zeneca has the episode synopsis for us.
The Baron's Bride originally aired on February 15th, 1988. Mickey and Ryan are transported to 1875 London, where, aided by an adventurous young writer, they set out to reclaim a cursed object from a bloodthirsty killer. Boom.
And this episode originally aired on February 15th, 1988, so there was no Friday the 13th for the 13th episode that this episode aired. Only 4 of the 12 Friday the 13th movies have actually come out on a Friday the 13th. I believe that to be correct. In the Friday the 13th game that's out right now, you can go through a virtual cabin, right, and look at all these factoids. And you kind of play like a mini game because you got to place certain objects in a certain way around and unlock puzzles. And it starts unlocking like scenes that play through where Jason like comes through the house or whatever, and he doesn't kill you, but he kind of walks through the scene. And you gotta you pick up the phone, you can call the police, you can make all these phone calls and things like that. And then there's one of the things on one of the calendars or whatever. You click on it, it tells you what Friday the 13th movies actually came out on Friday the 13th. For the first season, we don't have a Friday the 13th in February. I don't know if there's a Friday the 13th anytime this month, but when that episode airs on Friday the 13th, obviously we'll make a point to mention it.
Yes, totally, totally.
The episode was directed by Bradford May, who is a long history in television, let's just say. Most notably working on at least 40 episodes of JAG, and he was also the director of the two Darkman sequels.
Cool.
Yes, which were created by Sam Raimi. And he also directed several episodes of the remake of The Twilight Zone in the 80s. And they just recently announced that Jordan Peele, the director of Get Out, will be the director, the showrunner of the upcoming Twilight Zone revival.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to that. Oh my god, it'd be so good.
Yeah, I don't know who's going to host it yet, though, but the last one came out in the early 2000s, and it's a show we could cover on this podcast, because it got canceled after one season and was hosted by Forrest Whitaker.
Yeah, no, I love that franchise, Twilight Zone.
All right, so going on with our notes about the episode, we have Frank trying to rent a room, and Jack goes in search of the Jack and the gang go in search of the cape. I thought the cape made him look a lot like Barnabas Collins when he puts it on.
Yeah, it was very Dracula-like when I originally just, as soon as he put it on, I'm like, ooh, that popped collar just looks a little Dracula-like. And this was before I had known that it was actually a vampire-themed episode. The cape itself, it's like a black satin, and then it has a stand-up collar that is a good, like, 5 or 6 inches tall. Like, it's pretty gaudy looking. And then a diamond brooch that's the kind of the clasp. And so when Frank enters the room that he's supposed to rent, it's, like, laid out there on the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the widow is trying to pretty much entice him to put it on without saying a word about it. Which, that's a little bit more unusual for a cursed object, being that the actual power that this object possesses is that anyone who wears it is irresistible to the opposite sex. The widow was, I guess, lost her previous vampire, laid out this cape so that someone else can put it on, and therefore she would be attracted to that person. The logic to me didn't really fully flesh there, but yeah, whatever.
Yeah, it's a little strange. By the way, one thing I want to point out real quick, there's a YouTube channel called Curious Goods 2009, and it has every single promo for every single episode on their channel.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and I'm talking like, I think this is like every single promo for every single episode of the show.
Along with this cape, there's this little poem that is recited, and I'm not sure if this is just something that has to be recited for the cape's powers, or it's just something she made up, but it's like, now you and I, through eternity, will be bound, for this cape immortality is bound, and with this clasp, we could travel through time, just a drop of your precious blood mixed with mine. And then at that point, she reveals herself to be a vampire, and ha! You know, attack, mm-hmm. Vampire fangs, a whole bit.
What's funny is that this is one of those few actors that actually returns for another episode. He's in Eye of Death as Atticus Rook.
Oh, I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah,
I hadn't read that far in the Elise's book.
And also, the actor's name who plays our vampire, Frank, is Tom McCamus, and he's been on Orphan Black for seven episodes as Dr. Nielsen, if you ever watched that show. Nealon?
No.
Okay,
no.
He was Mason Eckhart in Mutant X, which is a kind of rip-off of the X-Men TV series that I've mentioned several times that was in syndication in the early 2000s. He was King John in King John. He was in Room, which was a big movie at the Academy Awards. He had a voiceover in Tangled.
Huh.
Yeah, so he's got quite the long longevity career going through the mid-80s to all the way to today in 2017.
Interesting. When the blood gets on the clasp, everyone gets transported in time. You know, the widow vampire gets killed, you know, with the, you know, room for rent sign, Ryan to the back. I thought that was pretty cool. But everyone else gets transported through time. So Frank and Mickey and Ryan are both transported in time to 1875. So March 12th, 1875, in London, of all places.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought they were going to go to, like, a Jack the Ripper type of thing, even though they already did that with Dr. Jack episode.
Yeah, because they definitely set it up to be more like a Whitechapel kind of time period than, you know, Dracula, which, hint, hint, nod, nudge, that obviously comes up very late into the episode.
Yeah, when I was doing some research on Bram Stoker, because the couple that they meet immediately after, you know, they get transported, is Abraham and Caitlin. Caitlin refers to Abraham once in the episode as Bram. The whole idea is this is the ideas that were put into his head to give him the fodder for writing Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, but here's the problem with this whole thing. These two are married, and Bram Stoker only had one wife in his entire life.
Yes.
One of the few celebrities, by the way, to only have one wife.
Yeah, her name was Florence Balcombe.
Correct. And they were married from 1878 till his death in 1912. There's no mention in the history of Bram Stoker of this woman, so pulling that out of there made it seem a bit ridiculous. Maybe if they hadn't married those two characters in that, and they had been like a girlfriend, you know what I mean? I would have believed that.
Yeah.
Because who the hell gives a crap about the girlfriends of famous person when they're kind of a footnote in the history of that person's biography? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and also since they set this in London, Bram Stoker wasn't actually in England until much later. Yeah. He was in Dublin at the time in 1875. So whether they could have moved the timeline up a bit, so when he was actually working for Henry Irving at the Lyceum Theatre in London, if they could have pushed back that date a little bit more time to give... You know, the timeline for Bram Stoker's life would have been more accurate. Or had they set the entire thing in Dublin, then that would have made more sense. You know,
yeah,
TV! Hey!
Yeah, basically. The actor playing Abraham's name is Kevin Bundy, which is kind of, you know, makes you remind you of a serial killer.
Or Married with Children.
Yeah, he has got a varied career in television. He's been on The Expanse and Dark Matter and Flashpoint, but, you know, nothing super huge in his career. But definitely an actor, by the way, I tried to reach out to try and find to see if he could come on the show. That unfortunately did not happen. But maybe in a couple weeks I will work on another actor to have on with us, because we try not to have anyone on that has been on a past episode because we're kind of already past it. So, like, moving forward, we will, you know, constantly try and look for an actor, maybe the actor of the week for the show, to come on with us to talk about the episode, if they're still alive. You know, it's sad. I used to have Roby's contact information, but I recently found out that she actually divorced the husband that put me in contact with her back in 2008, and she's been remarried since then, so I don't have his information, and it's all disconnected.
Yeah, you know, people move, people change. Yeah, hopefully we'll be able to get in contact with her through some sort of social media and... You know, get in contact that way.
Well, a lot of fans are actually kind of curious about what is she doing these days, because she hasn't touched her Twitter or Facebook in 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is an odd.
Correct. So, that's her fan pages, by the way. I'm not connected with her personally, but her fan pages have not been touched in almost 2 years. So, I'm not going to speculate. I'm just going to move on, and hopefully one day in the long time that we're going to be covering the show, we can get a hold of either John or Louise. So we will see. Or, God, I've even tried reaching out to Frank Mancuso Jr., who's the creator. You know, his father was the guy behind the Friday the 13th movies, and then he was the one who was just like, hey, television series. So...
Well, you know, we're going to be doing this show for a while, so we've got plenty of time on that.
Correct. Do you like how they changed to the black and white setting from the color? It's kind of like the reverse of The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. So they go back to 1875, and it's completely black and white. When they move forward in time, back to present day, it's color. I really like that touch to it. It's just some of the other things that are more historical timeline things that I have issues with.
Uh-huh.
I did like the acting from our Abraham, and Caitlin was just kind of thrown in there as just, you know, she didn't have a lot of lines. She didn't have a big part. She was not part of the adventure. But you did tell that they were really in love, and so when Frank the Vampire eventually killed her, you felt for the guy. You know,
Abraham, yeah, when she dies. I do feel for him. I don't really, she didn't have a big enough presence for me to care about her, but I felt his pain.
Yeah, so Mickey gets slashed by Frank pretty early on in the struggle, and then she is just basically mesmerized until the cape comes off of him.
Yeah, it's like, let's reinvent rules for vampires. So vampire just touches you, you're somehow in his thrall. You know, that always really annoyed me, that it was just like a slash would turn people. That's usually how it works with a werewolf and not a vampire. When we got to the Strain television series based on the novels by Guillermo del Toro and Chuck Hogan, I want to say the other author's name was, would turn you into a vampire because the vampire disease in the Strain was a biological-based virus. So contact with the vampire beyond just touching the skin, but any breaking of the skin would transfer it into you, because that's what would happen to people on that show. They would get slashed or cut or something, like by a zombie, and you would start to feel the effects of being changed. So
a lot of this episode uses the same beats as Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Correct.
You know, we have Mickey, who's under the spell, who can feel the presence of the vampire as he's around, desires to be near the vampire, someone protecting her, then the vampire hunter and the kind of friend, boyfriendish type of person stepping into that place. Abraham is, even though they're not, you know, any sort of romantic relationship, but that same type of archetype, you know, going after the vampire at night, you know, bringing the garlic these stakes made out of oak and the lantern. Very much, the pacing is a lot like Bram Stoker's Dracula. The one thing that I thought was kind of odd, and it was purely for the Friday the 13th, the series show, was that when he took off the cape after that first, I guess, night, Frank did, he suddenly grew grotesque. Like, his skin aged, he had, like, clawed hands, he was horrid looking. Then he put the cape back on and he was a youthful vampire again. And that is not in any sort of vampire lore, so that must be completely done for the power of the cape itself.
It seems like, by the way, there's more than just one object they need to acquire. It's the cape and the amulet.
Yeah, because the amulet is the clasp.
It completes it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's the time travel part, and then the cape does the immortality part as long as you're wearing it, I suppose.
It says that 2 shillings will get you a good night with a prostitute. I wonder how much that is today.
Give me a minute, and I can actually look that up. 2 shillings in modern money.
A stake of sharpened oak is very specific. It's not just any type of wood. It has to be sharpened oak.
Okay, so 2 shillings from 1875 would be in pound sterling, 38.28.
And how much is that in American?
I need to get into the
I don't know anything about the British currency. So, when, by the way, this guy's name, who's Abraham, we know the whole Bram Stoker thing, like we just went over it. It actually made me more think of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter or Abraham Van Helsing, which Abraham is, you know, maybe that's why he wrote that character into his book. If this guy became Bram Stoker in the Friday the 13th universe, it'd be interesting if he stuck his name Abraham in there as Abraham Van Helsing, and then, you know, years later, Seth Graham Smith would write Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Converging 38.2 pounds to U.S. dollars, that's $51.74.
That will get you nowhere with a prostitute. But maybe in 1988 it will. Maybe in 1988 it will get you somewhere with a prostitute.
I have no idea. Yeah, it depends on the prostitute, really.
Yeah.
How many sores they have.
I'm just speculating, you know. Not that I'm going to go and find out. But walking the streets of Worcester, I'm not going to lie and say I haven't been solicited to. That's funny is that I think of Mickey as becoming like the bride of this Nosferatu, which is what this guy kind of starts morphing into a little bit.
Yeah, and there's an internal dialogue scene where he is saying that she's the one I've been looking for, and it seems that that was supposed to be related to the Bram Stoker Dracula story, even though Abraham, as the writer, wouldn't be privy to that information.
Yeah, you mean how Mina is the reincarnation of Dracula's long-dead wife.
Exactly, exactly.
Which then, by the way, in some medias, it's Lucy. They just kind of... In a lot of medias, with the exception of Francis Ford Coppola's movie, which is the only one who actually fleshed out every single one of the characters in the Stoker novel, most medias will combine the Stoker characters into one person, or at least two people into one person, because of casting and, like, money constraints and things like that, and time that they have to fill. Francis Ford Coppola is the only one who ever actually took the novel from beginning to end, and for the most part, translated it correctly.
I was really paying attention to how much the writer himself would be exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that type of inner dialogue and those desires, the wants of the vampire or Mickey, or the struggle of Caitlin to defend Mickey when the vampire came bursting through, that wouldn't be privy to Abraham's writing. So it's that kind of gray area of writers' motivations,
mm-hmm,
where he could have guessed the motivation of the vampire, or someone gives him the clue in that that was his motivation, then that's what he's going to write about. Yeah, it's interesting. The Bram Stoker's Dracula book itself was actually written in 1896.
And in what year did they get transported to?
1897, and then they were transported in 1875.
Okay, I guess he could have wrote it. I mean, again, it's just a stretch that they're making him into Bram Stoker, is all.
Oh, it is. It is.
I kind of do wish that every episode was in black and white, but if you wanted to watch every episode in black and white, you just turn down the color saturation in your TV, and there you go. You get a black and white Friday the 13th TV series. It'd be kind of interesting. Maybe I'll go back and watch the first episode and see what that looks like.
Some episodes would be lended to it more than others.
Red's
ended looking a little more black.
Yeah, the problem is that the cinematography on the show is really bad. And the DVD that we got is a VHS transfer that I don't think it's cleaned up at all. Or if it is, it's a really bad cleanup process. It just does not look other care that CBS has put into their syndicated TV series. And maybe there's just no demand for it. I don't know. But the DVDs, I definitely always think, are kind of lacking in quality versus what they could be.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one day in the future we'll get a Blu-ray release of this show, but that's a
strictly remastered version.
Yeah, the remastered version of the Friday the 13th TV series. If they ever decide to remake it and actually call it Friday's Curse, maybe, or not call it Friday the 13th, the series, maybe the original will get some type of, like, super treatment. I mean, stranger things have happened.
That's true. That's true. It would be a labor of love for some producer.
Exactly.
So Mickey has been stolen by the vampire, and as soon as the vampire gets staked, when Abraham himself stakes the vampire because the vampire is lifting up Ryan by his head, about to kill him, and saying, "Oh, she's mine. No matter what she was to you before, she's mine." Stakes him right through the heart, then instantly the power and control the vampire had over Mickey is gone, and she is free to think her own thoughts, and her heart is not aching for the vampire as it was before.
This episode, by the way, have you ever heard of the author Brad Middleton?
It sounds familiar.
He's written many of books. One in particular I absolutely love is called Undead TV, The Ultimate Guide to Vampire Television. And he lists this episode in it, right below the entry for Freaks and Geeks, the trick-or-treat episode of the comedy show Freaks and Geeks, which, again, this guy lists every time a vampire has been on screen, whether or not they're fake or not, he puts it in the book, which is, like, some fucking dedication. The Baron's Bride, Friday the 13th. The team is transported back in time to 19th century London along with the newly turned vampire Frank Edwards. They cross paths with a young author named Abraham Stoker to investigate a series of murders committed by Jack the Ripper. I guess so. The subpar acting doesn't dull the charm of the story, which was primarily shot in glorious black and white. It does infer the real vampires inspired Bram Stoker to write his classic novel Dracula, which may bother those who dislike seeing real people fictionalized in this manner. It does bother me because I just thought that was the most ridiculous stretch of all time. Then there's Bottle of Dreams. I don't think that episode is a vampire episode, but it says, in this flashback episode, which is why we might not cover it, that includes scenes from Baron's Bride. Mickey and Jack relive the most horrible moments after a strange gas puts them into a trance. It's more like Bottle of Nightmares. This throwaway clip show forces the audience to relive some horrible acting. Yeah, there are clip show episodes of Friday the 13th, the series, which we are going to cover, but within like about 5 to 10 minutes. We're not going to go into great in-depth detail. We'll just happen to point out what episode it's from, the clip is from, and that's it. It's honestly, they're like about 75% clip show, 25% plot line involving somebody trying to steal the MacGuffin of the episode. So there will be that coverage, but it won't be that in depth. But that's not for a while. That's not until, I believe, oh, sorry, this is the last episode of season one, so.
Yeah, so the cape itself was mentioned in the previous episode. At least states in her book that that's one of the few times that a artifact from one episode gets kind of given its own episode, you know, later. So usually these episodes for Friday the 13th aren't connected at all,
mm-hmm.
but this has that mention in the Book of Objects,
mm-hmm.
the catalog. It says, oh, this the cape looks interesting to go after next. And so there they are, going after next.
Well, that's pretty much all the notes I have for this episode. How many people died in this one?
This one was a total of 5.
5, okay, and that includes the vampire himself.
Correct.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to play some promos from some other podcasts. We'll be back with more Dead TV Podcast in just a few moments.
What?
Have you ever read a Superman comic?
Not in the last few hours.
Oh, I was just checking, right? Just checking.
Hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey, and I have been a fan of Superman for as long as I can remember. In 1987, I started collecting the Superman comics as a going concern, which led me down a long and winding comic book-filled path to 2007 when I first started podcasting. Well, it's 2017, and because it's been 10 years since I started podcasting, and 30 years since I started reading Superman full-time, I thought it might be fun to start a new show called It All Comes Back to Superman. It All Comes Back to Superman will be my monthly reaffirmation of my Kryptonian faith, where I will pick out something about the Man of Steel and discuss it. Sometimes I'll be alone. Sometimes I'll have a guest. No matter how many people get involved, Superman will be the focus. It all comes back to Superman as part of the Fortress of Baileytube podcasting network. New episodes will drop on the 28th of every month. This show and all of the other programs that are part of the Fortress of Baileytude podcasting network can be found at www.fortressofbaileytude.com.
Hi, I'm Ellie, and this is Rob.
Howdy.
And we're the hosts of Horror Never Sleeps, a new weekly horror movie retrospective podcast. We will be reviewing your favourite scary movies like Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, and Psycho.
Also, we'll be covering classic gems like Maniac Cop, The Lost Boys,
The Human Centipede.
Whoa. No.
Oh, we'll see. First episode will be released mid-November. You can listen on iTunes or your favourite podcast app.
Until then, stay scared. Ooh.
Yeah, we won't be doing that.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca.
We're the hosts of a new true crime podcast called Yours in Murder.
We put out a new episode every week. We switch between covering true crime cases together and analyzing true crimes in our minisodes.
We take turns on the minisodes, focusing on our unique perspectives.
I have a degree in forensic science.
And I have one in journalism.
So we're able to go beyond Wikipedia and dive into the facts of the case. We look at the forensic evidence and the spin put on cases by the media.
Check us out on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and like us on Facebook for an update on today in true crime history.
As always, we are Yours in Murder.
Moon shines with the curse of a fiery death, and its evil waits for you.
Run! Oh, I got your share.
For every treasure found, a life must be lost.
You shed a little light on the subject.
Mickey's worst nightmare comes true.
Ready or not, here I come.
Throw the lantern over!
An all-new episode of Friday the 13th, the series. Next week, beware Hell's Fury.
And welcome back to the Dead TV podcast on our New Year's Eve recording. Again, this episode will air on January 5th, so we're recording it on New Year's Eve. And thanks to the other podcasters that we happen to be playing their promos for, they'll be playing our promo on their show. And this great little YouTube channel, Curious Goods 2009, actually has all of the commercial spots for every single episode of Friday the 13th series on it. So going forward, we're actually going to be playing these on the podcast. You can check out the whole video. And it's got that great voiceover guy who did a lot of commercials and trailers in the 80s and 90s. If you happen to know his name, stick it in the comment section below, because there's a few of those guys out there. But he definitely has one of those distinguishing voices that did trailers for everything. You know, I always remember him doing the trailers for Star Wars, especially when the special edition was coming out. He did the, for the last 20 years, people have been only able to watch Star Wars the only way possible on the TV screen. Now it's time for a change. And then, like, this little tiny screen, little tiny TV, you know, is surrounded in black because you're supposed to be watching Star Wars on the TV. Then an X-Wing and TIE Fighter come bursting out of the TV onto the big screen. Obviously, watching that now on YouTube or on your television at home, that doesn't have that kind of effect. But in 1996, when I went to go see Mars Attacks, and that was the trailer that was coming before the movie, my mind blew the fuck up seeing Star Wars coming back to the big screen. And that voiceover guy just really, like, let it out with the, welcome back, Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, R2-D2, Chewbacca, Han Solo, and Darth Vader. And I was just like, ah! So he does all the commercial spots for Friday the 13th, the TV series, and he's done a bunch more, but I got to do a little bit more research on, like, which one of the voiceover trailer guys that is. So we have the next episode with the episode synopsis for us, Bedazzled, not to be confused with a movie starring the actor from the Mummy movies.
Brendan Fraser
and Elizabeth Hurley played the devil in that, right? Isn't that a remake of an old movie too?
It is. It was also a movie, I think, by the same name. But the same premise, it's just a remake, and I kind of like the Brendan Fraser version.
Yeah, and the devil in the original was not a smoking hot British woman, right?
Oh, of course not.
All right, Mr. Zedeka has the episode synopsis for us.
Okay, episode number 14, Bedazzled. Originally aired February 22nd, 1988. Mickey is terrorized by a man looking for a magic lantern that has the power to find buried treasure.
Ooh, very cool. And I like the guy who directed this episode, Alexander Singer. Man, he directed some stuff. He is like a huge TV director, directing Star Trek: The Next Generation, which, oh, coincidentally, aired the same time as this show. Wow, I wonder how he got that job. Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Voyager, Walker Texas Ranger, which was fucking awesome, In the Heat of the Night, MacGyver, Cagney and Lacey, Knots Landing, Hill Street Blues, Remington Steele, starring future James Bond, Pierce Brosnan, Dallas, Lou Grant, Pearl, Police Story, Police Woman, The Bold Ones, Mission Impossible, The Monkees, The Fugitive, and Lost in Space.
Wow.
Yeah, this guy had a huge television directing career. But unfortunately, the last thing he worked on was like Star Trek Voyager, so there's no accounting if he's passed away or not, but yeah, maybe he just, man, he must have worked in television at a time when TV directors are getting paid bank.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, huge career. So, moving on with the episode.
Okay, so the episode begins, and it's an underwater salvage project.
Yeah, which is kind of a different opening for the show.
Yeah. We've never really seen an underwater shot until now.
No, we've never had the show open up with the gang already there going for the thing. But that's to set up the plot line later on in the episode, too. But I like the fact that we're not just going right to Curious Goods and going, oh, no, it was sold to John Smith. We have to get to John Smith's house. What do you mean John Smith's dead? It was given to his son. Now his son is killing people.
Yeah, this episode just jumps right into it. Like, Jack and Ryan are basically watching this chest be raised and put on deck, and then the chest be opened, and then the lantern be used on someone. And so this is one of those computer graphics areas, the very sparing computer graphics that they have in the show, where the beam of light coming from the lantern itself shines onto the victim and then lights him on fire. You know, burns him up and kind of consumes him.
And it kind of reminds me of this right here.
In brightest day, in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power.
Yeah, not quite the Green Lantern.
More like the
Sinestro Corps lantern where it would kill you.
Yeah, this is much larger than the Green Lantern's lantern. And it's one of those very maritime lanterns that you'd hang off the end of a boat. It can be seen a long distance. It's very powerful. It's made out of brass. And, you know, I did a little bit of calculation on this. So in order for light to be focused enough to set things on fire, there's a very simple calculation, and so from the sun, we have about 1 kilowatt per square meter, and so that equals about 0.6 watt per square inch. Now, if you take 63 square inches of that, and that's roughly about 38 watts of energy. If you focus that 38 watts into an area about of an eighth of an inch, then that will actually be enough wattage to set something on fire. You know, it can even melt a penny or boil water. Now, since we're dealing with a cursed object here, we have to really understand that the light bulb inside is not the actual power source. It is the devil's fire. So that devil's fire has to be hot enough to not only cover that 1/8 square inch focused, but that beam of light was almost, what do you say, about 5 inches?
Yeah, it's something like that.
5 inches... let me just double check my calculations here. For every inch, that's about 304 watts of power. And so that's about 1,520 watts of power in order to get a focused beam of about 5 inches in order to actually set something on fire. So that is an incredible amount of wattage and focus that that would have to have. But of course, you know, this is a cursed object. Devil's fire, it's immeasurable, really. But I thought that was pretty interesting. So using a Fresnel lens as the focusing mechanism for the glass in the front,
mm-hmm.
and that's how you would focus that energy to be, you know, able to light a guy on fire like that.
Now, do you happen to own a brass lantern?
I don't own a brass lantern, but I do have about 6 Fresnel lenses.
Ah, I don't own a brass lantern, but I own lanterns that were left over as promo items for a movie called Insidious Chapter 2. Mrs. Zenica and I were discussing the Insidious movies off the air before we began recording, and she hasn't seen any of them, but in the movie, they constant theme to use to look into, like, the gray where the ghosts happen to live and kind of get your way around is a lantern. So that's a huge prop in every single one of the Insidious movies is a lantern. So they made it into a cool little promo item, battery-operated, of course, for the films.
Cool, yeah.
Yeah, it's a. I don't remember if it's a brass lantern in the Insidious movies, but again, every one of the Insidious films has a lantern, and it's used to help ward off the evil spirits, or not ward them off, but like navigate the person through where they have to go inside the spirit world. And what better thing to use than like a lantern? You know, maybe you wouldn't use like a flashlight or a torch, as it's also called sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can also find lanterns depicted on the tarot card, The Hermit. And that card means to light your way. So the light of the lantern is to guide your way through something. So, you know, that's also a very poetic way of, you know, in the movie Insidious to show that.
They get the lantern back to Curious Goods, and it's like, wow, the episode could end right there. But the unkilling machine that is Jonah, which is the name of the main bad guy, the evil Popeye, as I like to call him, yeah, he follows the trail back to where he knows the lantern came from. Because they don't go into a lot of the backstory of, like, who had the lantern originally? Where did the lantern come from? Yada, yada, yada. All the stuff that they normally do.
They do actually mention it. I caught it that Jonah had bought the lantern from Uncle Lewis back when it was the store was called something else.
Yeah, but that was it. They don't go into, like, who made the lantern or where the lantern comes from, other than the fact that we know the devil cursed it, as he did all the other objects in here.
True.
The most ridiculous object, by the way, is coming up soon in the episode with the electric chair. Who the fuck buys an electric chair at a goddamn antique store? I mean, Jesus Christ.
Frankenstein?
Okay, yes. Psycho serial killer collectors or people into some weird kinky stuff a la like yourself would. But what prison is going to buy an electric chair from an antique store? They would have it made where electric chairs are made, but that's the whole thing we're going to get into in the next podcast in 2 weeks. I just happen to look ahead a little bit to find out what other antiques are coming up that are kind of ridiculous. Oh boy, what's next?
But unlike a lot of the other cursed objects that have had multiple owners since the time it left the store, this one has only had one.
Uh-huh.
So Jonah bought it from Lewis, and then it's, you know, they took it away from him. And so he says, it's rightfully mine, I paid for it. And so the power of the lantern is really that you shine it down at the sunken ship, you know, that they're salvaging, and the treasure of that wreckage miraculously appears. But then you have to feed the lantern, and you feed the lantern by shining the light on the diver that brought it up as payment.
They also introduced this kid, Richie. We haven't seen this kid beforehand, right?
No, not at all.
Okay, just want to make sure. I was trying to make sure I'm not confusing him with the kid that Ryan kind of takes under his wing that reminds him of his brother. I was like, wait a minute, is that that kid? Is this the new family that was adopted him? Because it would have been...
No, that's a completely different actor, for one.
True, but that doesn't seem to matter when it comes to kids. I can swap them out 12 times in the same season. I thought that would have been maybe like a cooler nod to a previous episode if this was like the new family he was with, you know? And, you know, they would feel comfortable with Ryan and Mickey watching him, considering, you know, the whole backstory where he comes from, but...
Yeah,
no,
I think, wasn't that kid's name, like, Jordy?
Yeah, no, I knew it was after a little while. I didn't mean like I'm asking you, but I just kind of hoping maybe that would have been a great little nod to a previous episode to keep in continuity with that kid. I don't think he ever comes back again later on, but I do. They also seem to mention that they know about the big vault downstairs, you know what I mean? They're thinking there's going to be gold and stuff like that. Jumping ahead just a little bit, there's a scene where Roby has him in the vault, Mickey. Wouldn't it have made more sense to push the door closed? Because there's no way to get out of the vault if you're inside it, if the door is closed. There's no levers, there's no buttons, there's no handles, there's nothing on that door to get yourself out. There's no panic room button or anything.
No. Like, once you're locked inside, you cannot get out. And I think he actually did. He closed it because he turned that brick that they had to turn in order to open the vault.
Correct.
But the most mysterious thing about the vault was that they tried to use the blowtorch on it, and they're like, what is the thing made out of? And it's almost
evil.
As if it was, like, magically sealed.
Yeah, probably by Jack probably has a priest come over once a week, kind of like Lorraine Warren has a priest that comes over blessing the room that all the goofy objects that her and her husband Ed collected over the years, including the Annabelle doll, once a week. So I guarantee Jack probably has something done to that vault, like once a week, once a month, to make sure everything inside it stays permanently locked up.
Yeah, probably. I that's what I was assuming when the blowtorch wouldn't cut through it.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that did rise a question to me is that she is filled, you know, surrounded by dangerous cursed objects. Now, sure,
just
if
throw
you use
the, doll,
the objects...
Just throw the doll from the first episode at the guy and then run away.
I mean, pretty much, yeah.
That little
like,
doll would start, like, going...
dangerous objects.
Slashing and cutting his neck open and stuff. I mean, it's a psychotic little doll that keeps appearing, so we know it's still, like, possessed by the curse of the devil.
I mean, they do allow these objects to be used every once in a while during an episode once they find out what it does. And they do use the objects occasionally to, such as in the last episode, the Claft, to return back to time. So I would think that she would have this kind of running tally of what all of these objects do, and then find the one that she could use without harming her soul in the process. And as soon as the door is open, instead of knocking him on the back of the head, just, you know, like you said, just throw the doll at him, or, you know, use one of the other objects that will definitely hurt him, but hopefully not, you know, pay too big of a price for her.
Now, I'm wondering if this is just a matter of, like, time constraints and the writers didn't think about these sort of things and police procedures. But don't tell me that they didn't understand police procedures, how they work in television, because the number of cop dramas in the 80s was so fucking huge, okay? Even before the 80s, we've had cop dramas on before, and they go into procedure, what cops do. This cop shows up, discovers a body, but doesn't call it in for backup, knowing that there's something going on.
Yeah, no backup whatsoever.
He goes and knocks on the door of Curious Goods like, hello, I found the dead body, dope, dope, dope. He was a cop, right? He wasn't a security guard?
Yeah, no, he was a cop.
Okay.
And the other sailor guy did not answer the questions properly.
Correct.
Know, he said, yeah, our telephones are fine. You know, when,
and
you
he
know,
just opens fire without freeze. Put your hands in the air. You know, anything that a cop does before shooting. And of course, this is the 80s. This is, you know, maybe police procedures were different back then.
I don't know. As soon as you see a dead body, it's like, okay, call for backup.
Now,
backup, please.
Now, Zeneca, what was the name of the telephone company that the telephone operator was working for before he was killed?
Oh, man, I didn't write that down.
Okay, I thought I wrote it down, but that maybe give us a clue about where the fictitious... here it is. It's Statewide Telephone. Now, I'm wondering if that is an actual telephone company anywhere, and give us the exact location of where Curious Goods happens to be.
Statewide Telephone?
Yes.
There is the Texas Statewide Telephone Cooperative, Wisconsin Statewide Telephone Cooperative. Yeah, that seems to be about it. So what I found is that there is the Texas Statewide Telephone Cooperative or the Wisconsin Statewide Telephone Cooperative. So two companies with the statewide telephone. What you have to also remember is that the storm that they're in is a tropical storm that has been upgraded to a hurricane. So hurricanes are only going to be available along the coastline.
Correct.
So, you know,
and where
that
is Vancouver?
Mystery of where is Curious Goods.
Now, does Vancouver border a body of water?
No.
No. Okay, so they cannot be in Vancouver, even though it was most likely shot. It was shot there, right? Isn't that where we established early on with Elise?
Let me just double check.
It's in her book. I know that.
Actually, no, sorry. I made a mistake. Vancouver does actually border.
Okay, Vancouver does border a body of water. It borders the ocean, right?
Yes.
Okay, because again, and it's never quite said where this town, where Curious Goods actually is. So,
but I also don't think that Vancouver has tropical storms.
No,
because the definition of tropical storm would be originating from the tropics.
Yeah. So
that would be mainly either Florida, South Carolina, Georgia area, all the way up to, I guess, Virginia.
Correct. And another person in one of the other Friday the 13th groups said that it's most likely takes place in, like, the Carolinas.
I mean, the Carolinas do get tropical storms and hurricanes.
There's a great little Starix note at the end of this chapter in Elise's book, Curious Goods, behind the scenes of Friday the 13th, where she points out, Jonah is the bad guy who wouldn't die. Like Michael Myers or Jason Voorhees, ha ha ha, he just keeps coming up back for more. He gets electrocuted, he gets hit in the head multiple times to the point someone should have had a concussion and been knocked out cold, and falls from a second story and is still ticking.
Yeah. You see that curled hand that just kind of twitches and like, oh, he's not down yet.
The other funny thing is that this basically is the Women in Jeopardy but Home Alone style trapping episode, because she is the woman in Jeopardy left alone as the men went to a convention that never actually happened because of the storm, and she's left home alone to create all sorts of Home Alone style traps.
Well, there was only the electrocuting, really, was a trap.
Yeah.
You know, which I thought was kind of brilliant of her to do. The most curious thing about it is that after the whole ordeal, when Jack and Ryan are relaying their story of what their night was, she doesn't, you know, do a story topping like, well, let me tell you about my night.
Yeah.
Instead, the mother of the kid, you know, comes over and says, oh, you should not tell them ghost stories anymore. You know, and, you know, the mention of the lantern is what gets Jack and Ryan looking at each other like, what?
Yeah.
You know, like,
also, that entire store would be under, a police officer was killed there, and two other people were found dead. Sorry, three other people were found dead, including the telephone guy and then the two sailors. So there would be a police investigation. The whole place would be cordoned off with yellow tape, and Mickey would be meeting them outside, having to explain what happened.
Yes.
We'd be lucky if the store was reopened at any time.
Yeah, because investigations would go on. There'd be bloodstains everywhere. Those killings were not clean. And the smell of cooked of human would still be in the air because, you know, Mickey uses the mirror to reflect the shine of the lantern back at Jonah. There would be no way that she'd be able to cover it up.
Yeah, and he dies in a very Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of way.
Yeah, he kind of looked a little like a roast.
Mm. The mirrors also appear in Bottles of Dreams, Doorway to Hell, for two other episodes that are on this show.
Yes. Yeah. All right, and I think that's all the notes I have.
Yeah, that's pretty much all the notes I have as well. We appreciate...
We didn't talk about the MacGuffin, though, from the first episode with a cape.
Oh, yeah, we forgot about that. Okay.
Do you own a cape?
I don't own a cape, and I don't own a brooch, an amulet, a thing, a clip to keep a cape together. Do you?
I don't own capes. I own three cloaks, which are different. You know, they're the hooded styles. I own three cloaks, and I only have one brooch.
I figured you at least would have that. That definitely is a female accessory. Excuse me, that's the word I was looking for. Appendage. accessory to have more than a man would.
Have you been starting your New Year's Eve drinking early?
yes, it's called Vitamin Water Zero. No, I forgot to bring alcohol with me while I'm recording this, and I'm going to be up till like 2 a.m. Playing music from Todd in the Book of Pure Evil, which is a show that somebody, thankfully, thank you, on our... You can leave comments on the Facebook page for the Dead TV podcast, and we will respond to them. And I did love the question being asked, are we going to cover Todd in the Book of Pure Evil and Reaper? And I said, yes, eventually, hopefully get to both of them. But we'll be on Friday the 13th for a really long time, because there's 70-something episodes for this show. Yes, even though it was canceled, it still did run for 70 episodes. But as we've stated before, we're going to be taking a break in April for a big comic book tie-in, as we're going to be covering Spawn the Animated Series for 6 weeks before we begin Season 2. And, of course, ties into a huge month in comic books in April of 2018 as the first comic book to hit issue 1,000 will be printed, Action Comics number 1,000. So mm-hmm. we'll be tying Spawn into that, as Todd McFarlane has a lot to say about Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. We'll get into all that good stuff at the beginning of April, and we'll have somebody from Trick or Treat Radio back on the show with us, and we'll get back to it then. But tune back in in two weeks as we cover the next two episodes in Friday the 13th, the series Vanity Mirror and Tattoo, which I will have a lot to say about tattoos, as I have 8 of them. But we'll cover more about that soon. Don't forget, you can check us out on the Facebook page, as I mentioned, and we have our individual Twitters, Chris D. S-A-V.
And at Elegantly Kinky.
And Happy New Year, Mr. Zeneca, and thank you very much for the gift for Christmas.
Happy New Year, and thank you for the book. This is great.
Yes, definitely. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
May we have another great year podcasting today.
Yes, definitely. We have a lot to cover in 2018. So tune in for more, and don't forget all the previous episodes and the past shows that we've covered the past year can be found on RadioHorror.com, not WordPress.com, as that's the site dedicated to the radio show, Dr. Chris's Radio Horror, but RadioHorror.com, where you can check out all of our previous podcast episodes. Good night, everyone.
Good night.